Welcome to another edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you exactly like it is. And this is episode number 191, 191. And as always, if you have any questions or comments, you can email them to me at kbmakel@aol.com, or you can post them on the comment section of Podbean. So, that's how you can get in touch with us, and we've got some good stuff for today. First of all, I'm still steamed about the Super Bowl parade shooting. You have these dirtbags. They went armed to this thing. And, you know, a majority of their victims were children. And I don't care about race. I don't care about the race of anybody who is, whether they were perpetrator or victim or anything else. This is a horrible, horrible thing. And yet it's kind of being swept under the rug. The media doesn't really want to cover it. They don't want to expose the fact that armed gangs are essentially operating with impunity in cities. They don't want to say that. Yet, they're the first ones to say, you should give up your firearms. You should give up your rights. That'll make things better. Well, I don't see how that makes anything better. And I don't really want anyone to think that the stuff they spew has any credibility at all, because it doesn't. It absolutely does not. And frankly, you know, our society just, it goes back to what I was saying before. There are people who live in these false realities where bad is good, good is bad, what they say is the truth is actually the truth, facts don't matter, only emotions matter, and the news media aids and abets that. They aid and abet it. I mean, we've seen it over the last three decades. They try the drumbeat. And it worked in 1994. They got an assault weapons ban. You know, they do this drumbeat of, hey, these things are everywhere, and they report every possible crime that they can link to them, even when they're not linked to it. I don't want to explain it all, but anyway, the news media aids and abets it, and they put on the drumbeat. And so that everybody is marching towards the only solution can be another gun law. Well, we found out that that doesn't work very well, as we had told them it wouldn't. So there they are. And then, you know, again, I'm still steamed about Mayor Quentin Lucas. I like calling him Lucas, but that's not very nice. But anyway, this fool, when the governor calls the people who perpetrated this horrible crime, one of the worst crimes in the history of the city, when you look at it. When you look at the history of Kansas City, this Super Bowl shooting is a very bad event. Probably the worst one. Now, granted, you know, one person was killed. The I think she was a Latina lady, disc jockey or music, had something to do with music on a radio show. So, a radio show host, I guess, would be the best way. She was killed, and everybody else was just injured. And I'm like, well, that's just horrific, especially the number of children. So when these guys are called thugs by the governor, Quentin Lucas actually defended them by saying, "Hey, that's a dog whistle to, you know, essentially make a racist comment." And what I'd like to ask Quentin Lucas is, well then, okay, what should we call them? What do you call them? What should we call them? You call them something. If you say we can't call them thugs, okay, then what is the alternative? And he, I'm sure, couldn't offer anything because he's, number one, he's not very smart, and number two, and hasn't thought this through. Until then, they are thugs. And it has nothing to do with what they look like. It has everything to do with how they act. So, kind of leaving that behind, I've decided to move a question that I received up into this part of the podcast because it's probably a little more lengthy answer. And this is from a listener, Michael. And I'm going to kind of read this, kind of see you get the gist of this with the words without me, you know, having to paraphrase too much. On a previous podcast, I overheard you speak of a family member that was in World War II. He was issued an M1 carbine but didn't like it, so he dumped it to pick up a German weapon. That is 100% true. My uncle parachuted into Normandy. And I'm going to kind of answer this in parts. That is very true. He parachuted into Normandy. Now, these guys were kind of cut off. It wasn't like they linked up with the ground troops right away. So there was a period of time, a significant period of time, where they were out running around trying to delay the Germans and create havoc in the what would be the German rear area, which would be forward of the Allied lines. And, you know, I was too young. I didn't ask him. I know he was not very impressed with the carbine. He didn't like it very much. He said, "I didn't really like it. I got rid of it, and I got a German machine gun." And I think he meant submachine gun, but I was too young to ask him at the time. Now, compared to, I'm sure part of the problem was they weren't getting any resupply of ammo. And as they were getting, as they would find the Allied lines, or the Allied lines would advance and find them, they were kind of getting absorbed into it and, you know, sent to the back. So what you had out front is what you had. So I'm sure that when he ran low on ammo, that was probably a consideration. And face it, in the German rear area, you can find, you know, trucks with ammunition in it. You could find maybe little caches of, you know, for resupply. You could certainly find it from people who were killed in battle. You know, you could find ammunition for German weapons. So that might have been part of it. But I know he wasn't impressed. I mean, face it, semi-automatic M1 carbine compared to a fully automatic Smyser, you know, MP40 Smyser submachine gun. In close quarters battle, you know, you the submachine gun is really advantageous, even though the carbine is, I like them. I think they're kind of good little weapons, but, you know, obviously the submachine gun had some advantages. And I would say those advantages were fully automatic, 30-round magazines versus a 15-round magazine. When you're running around the rear area, the signature of the weapon might not immediately give you away as an American. You know, our weapons sound different from theirs. Theirs sound different from ours. And, you know, you can pick up on that. That could be something that could give you away. So maybe it was a combination of all those things. So that's kind of the first part. The next part is, I have read and listened to documentaries which veterans describe dumping their issue weapon for an enemy weapon. I listened to one speaker discuss a situation in World War II in which a number of American soldiers were taken prisoner and temporarily housed in a barn. Their captured weapons were dumped outside. A person living on that farm described to the speaker that he would see the German soldiers go through the piles and take American weapons for their own use. Reportedly, the M1 carbine was the favored weapon. You know, and again, the grass is always greener. It depends on what kind of weapon that you're issued also. If you're issued a 5-round Mauser 98K, an M1 carbine is a fairly attractive weapon to replace it with, at least temporarily. It's lighter, easier handling, 15-round capacity. If you didn't have the submachine gun or something else, and this afforded the opportunity to get a weapon with a little better firepower, yeah, I could see where they would take that. You could definitely see that. Or if they were low on their own ammunition and couldn't get it, and hey, we've got this pile of enemy weapons and we've got, you know, several basic loads of ammunition for it, that might be a factor also. So that's pretty interesting. Here's the rest. Later, the roles were reversed, and captured German soldiers were temporarily housed in a barn with their captured weapons piled up outside. The farm residents saw American soldiers searching through captured weapons. The most popular were Lugers. Yes, that is not a surprise. The Luger was the number one souvenir of both world wars. So I would say that's probably not so much of exchanging a 1911 for a Luger. I don't think that's the case at all. I think the case is I want a Luger as a souvenir, and I was not issued a handgun, and here's a handgun. Even though it's an enemy one, now I have a handgun as a backup weapon. So, but I think souveniring is probably the greatest factor in there, and having a sidearm as a backup is probably secondary. But I can see where that would happen. Lugers, then and now, are very, very desirable. And then it goes, in the movie Fury, they depicted the main character with a German STG-44. That is true. Brad Pitt played the tank commander, and he's got an STG. Whether STGs were really prevalent in the Battle of Normandy, Battle of France, and into Germany, I'm not that sure. I know a lot of them were used on the Eastern Front, and I'm sure some of them were on the Western Front. You know, that's just whatever that is. The funny part is, I noticed he did not have any spare magazines or any kind of, you know, ammunition supply for it. So he had this kind of cool weapon, but I didn't see any real support stuff for it. You could always assume it's there, but I think it was a very cool weapon, and it looked cool, and I think that's why the movie producers used that. And here's the last part of the question. My question concerns the practicality of doing that. I would suspect that replacement ammunition could be found on downed or captured enemy soldiers, but I would think that supply would be limited, unlike the normal supply soldiers would use. What is your opinion on using enemy weapons? I can tell you that during the Vietnam War, both sides used captured weapons. The Vietnamese, simply because they, you know, any weapon was a weapon, so a weapon was a weapon, however they got it, whether it was foreign aid or captured or however it was procured, and they just dealt with the ammunition situation as best they could. So that was that's part of it. The U.S. side used captured weapons because if you're on a patrol deep in the enemy area, again, our weapons sound different from their weapons. So an AK, a couple of rounds popping off from an AK might not attract the attention that some strange sounding rifle would, being basically an M16 or even an M14, you know. So those types of things, you know, were factored in. There were people who thought the AK, I'm sure, was better and they would use it. You know, all this kind of stuff. There's always that little bit of the grass is always greener type of deal. And I think even during the Vietnam War, that surreptitiously AK ammunition was actually produced in the United States because there was such a use of these weapons. And there was also, you know, a use of these weapons in training. This is what the enemy has. This is what it sounds like. This is what its capabilities are. Well, in order to determine all these things and demonstrate them to your troops, you have to, you know, fire them, and you have to have a supply of ammunition for that. So, you know, that's the Vietnam War piece of that. Captured weapons. I have used captured weapons, and I will articulate it now. In Iraq, I was in a place where there were all kinds of different government entities. I was the only military guy. It was in a compound that was guarded by Blackwater contract troops from Colombia, and they had some sort of a Galil looking rifle, fired 5.56, but it was a Galil. It wasn't a NAR M16 type weapon. So they had that, and the area we were in was notionally controlled by the Kurdish Peshmerga, which is their militia. So we were in kind of, and they were, of course, equipped with AKs that they had inherited from the Iraqi army. They also had tanks, all kinds of things that they inherited from the Iraqi army when it collapsed after the invasion. So all this stuff is out there floating around. I basically made a decision that although I had an M4 and an M9 pistol and an M4 carbine, that it would be advantageous if I also maybe had something that didn't sound U.S. So I procured a former Iraqi Army Kalashnikov with several magazines of ammunition, with the idea that if our little base, if our little outpost was overrun, that I would could use that to exfiltrate the base, and if I ran across anybody hostile, an AK firing would probably not attract the attention that an M4 would due to the difference in sound. And of course, we know that people in that part of the world, there's a lot of celebratory fire, so a few rounds from an AK wouldn't attract that much attention. They would also use an AK, like the Iraqi police. They would use it to control crowds, fire it up in the air, make everybody run to the side so they could go down a road, all kinds of stuff. So hearing an AK go off wouldn't have been a red flag or an immediate attraction getter. So I kept an AK for that reason. As I had to occasionally bathe, and the bathing facility was on the other side of this little outpost, I used to have to trek there from where my quarters were, my little hooch. And so I kept another ex-Iraqi weapon, a British Sterling submachine gun in 9mm, and I had several magazines for it, and I essentially just had it in a plastic bag in the bottom of a parachute kit bag, that I would carry to the bathing facility. And what I would do is I had, that's encased because, you know, things always happen at the worst times. One of my biggest fears was, well, what happens if you're in the shower and this place gets hit, they breach the perimeter, and you're away from, you know, your stuff? You know, I wasn't that far away, but you know, I'd have to go back and unlock it. So I wanted a weapon that would be with me, and then I wanted a weapon that, again, wouldn't attract a lot of attention. So I had that, and I had it folded up. I had it in a plastic bag, and it was in the bottom of this kit bag with the magazines of ammo. And, you know, when I was in the shower, I always wore them in the shower. I wore things, they were called Tevas, I think. And they were a big, heavy-duty sandal that strapped onto your feet. So you could go out and run these things. They were like shoes. They just, the top was open like a sandal. And the water would drain out. It wouldn't hold any water or anything. And I also I'd also make sure I had laid out a shirt and gym trunks. So in case anything happened, I would immediately just jump into those, pull out that weapon, and, you know, get to where I needed to go. So those are my experiences with captured weapons. Of course, I wasn't able to keep any of these things as souvenirs. I gave them back when I left country. But, you know, that's how it works. That was my deal. And, you know, again, the ammunition was easy. There was plenty of AK ammunition laying around. Nobody cared. There was plenty of 9mm laying around. Nobody cared. So it was pretty easy. So those are the three, you know, the paratrooper who's behind the enemy line, in front of the Allied lines, in the enemy's area. That's one whole situation. Another situation is, hey, the guys see a pile of weapons and they want to upgrade. Another one is they see a pile of weapons and want souvenirs. And another one is, well, because of the signature differences in weapons, it might be smart to have something that doesn't sound like your M4 in case you have to escape the compound. Or it may be smart to have something that doesn't sound like your M4 that's nice, compact, foldable, that you can take with you surreptitiously to places like the shower, or you could even carry it as a secondary weapon in your your day pack type of deal. Those are all reasons why an enemy weapon might fill the bill. So I hope I answered that sufficiently. Is it just a good policy to say, man, you used to hear this all the time. Oh, the AK is so much better than the M16. I'll throw away the piece of shit M16 and pick up an AK. Well, you know, that might not be the best plan for ammunition availability, for people hearing what sounds like an enemy weapon close by. They may think that, oh, that's a bad guy there, so we'll just recon by fire and light up the bushes we think he's hiding behind. Those kind of things all sort of matter. And you have to weigh the risks and take the possibilities and kind of just give it your best shot. I told you what my best one was, so I hope that answers the mail. Okay, the next thing I want to talk about, it's a little bit crazy, but here we go. There is a TV series that you get on BritBox, which is, you know, one of the subsidiary things of Amazon Prime. It's called Dad's Army, and it's about the British Home Guard in World War II. And it was made in the 1960s, and it's kind of this madcap comedy. A lot of it is very British, so it doesn't really strike, you know, with American audiences. And a lot of it is very dated, you know, the kind of the plots are you know, very, you know, what was thought about as being very comical then is kind of looked upon as being really super corny today. But anyway, one of the reasons I was watching some episodes is I'm just fascinated with the weapons that you see. Even in the 1960s, when, you know, people really weren't that detail-oriented towards the weapons and do I have the correct ones and everything. So they have P-14s, P-14 Enfield rifles, you know, manufactured by the United States during World War I for the British, given to the British, or I should say purchased by the British. They used it a little bit, tested it out, thought the SMLE, their older rifle, was actually a better fit for the type of combat in the trenches, so the P-14s all went into reserve use. Few of them, some portion, were given away as military aid after World War I. Large numbers were in stores. And in World War II, they broke these things out again and handed them out to the Home Guard, which were the, you know, citizen volunteer defenders. And, you know, before you laugh at them, because some of them were elderly, you know, some of them had pre-Boer War, you know, ribbons and things. But 1,200 of them were killed during World War II because they manned anti-aircraft guns. They did a whole bunch of different things. And there were even some units that were trained that should an invasion of Britain happen, that they would sabotage bridges and blow up things and do things like that. So it wasn't a complete joke, but the TV show makes it that way. So anyway, the upshot of this is, I was watching the P-14 quite a bit, so I took my P-14 out, and I was shooting it, and I was having a very good time with it. Then I thought, you know, really, this is such a good rifle, because it really is. What is it like really kind of compared to the SMLE, you know, the British Short Magazine Lee Enfield, the rifle I think they adopted that in, you know, 1907, 1908, and you know, it was basically through two world wars. So, like, well, if the P-14 was better, why didn't they, you know, convert to that after the First World War? Or if the P-14 is inferior, what are those inferiorities? As just a quick review, the P-14 descended from the P-13, which was a Mauser-style design that was inspired after the British with their Long Lee, their Lee Enfield and Lee Metford rifles. They felt those were outclassed in the Boer War, 1899 to, you know, 1902, whatever that was. So they felt that, hey, these guys are, you know, they're outranging us, because the Boers had 7mm Mauser rifles, Mauser 95 rifles. And their cartridge was flatter shooting. They could shoot at long ranges. They were very natural marksmen and outdoorsmen for the most part. So the British felt that they needed a new rifle that would be superior. They developed the P-13, which had kind of like a 7mm Magnum. If you can imagine the 7mm Remington Magnum type performance, that's what they wanted. They found that it burned barrels out very quickly, given the metallurgy at the time. Had a lot of recoil, a few other things. And then, of course, the war. You know, the P-13 meant 1913. Obviously, August 1914, the World War starts. The British government says, you know, halt development on this thing. Hold it. Just hold it. We're going to fight the war with the SMLE. That's just the way it is, because we've got them. We got the ammunition. We're going to make them. We're going to do this. But they were afraid they would have a shortfall of rifles, so they contracted with three American firms, Remington Eddystone, which was in the old Baldwin locomotive factory. And I know this because my great uncle was an inspector there. So then regular Remington UMC and Winchester to make the P-13 rifle chambered in 303 British, and thus it became the P-14. Now there are some other minor changes too, but that's basically the upshot story. So we, meaning the United States, these three companies produce 1.2 million of these things. By the time they get delivered to the British have solved their rifle shortage problem. So they really don't need these, but they take them because they paid for them, and they use them. But it, you know, the SMLE, as even though its ancestor rifles, the Lee Metford and Long Lee Enfield, had performed kind of poorly against the Boers, the SMLE, its descendant, which was just a shorter version of the rifle, was performing exceptionally well because the ranges were shorter, the magazine capacity was great, it had a smooth action. There was no need for a five-shot Mauser rifle. There just wasn't a need for it. So they were all in second-line duties. And in the Second World War, they armed the Home Guard and a few other things. So I wanted to take them in. It's always subjective doing a head-to-head comparison. But in firing both rifles, my observations are the P-14 is very accurate. It's very accurate. It's smooth shooting. It has a excellent sight system for both close in and long range. It's definitely reliable. It's definitely strong. It's definitely a great rifle. There's no two ways about it. The SMLE now has a shorter sight radius with more crude sights. It's got a two-piece stock. They are not renowned for accuracy, although I don't know that and that turns out to be not a problem in World War I because the combat ranges are comparatively short. You know, 200 yards and less. 300 yards would be an extremely long shot with anybody in World War I. That's just the truth of it. But the 10-round magazine is a very, very nice feature. To go in and not have to do that reload after five rounds, that could be a big deal. Unfortunately, they never realized its potential by issuing spare magazines with it, because it's actually very easy to change magazines on the Lee Enfield. But I'm sure they thought, well, the loss rate would be so catastrophic, and if you lose, you know, your magazines, why, then you've got a single shot rifle at best. And so I'm sure they that's why they did what they did, and you just kept the same magazine in the rifle and loaded it with charger clips, you know, what we call stripper clips, charger clips. I think they missed the potential. I think they could have made the 10 shot magazine, could have been a 15. Doesn't look like it would be a big deal to make that bigger. They're both the rifles, the P-14 and the SMLE, are cock on closing, which I don't personally care for. I've seen the British muzzle loaders and a few of the YouTubers who are used to that system because maybe they grew up in Europe or grew up in a British Empire influenced place, and they slap that bolt open and shut, so it's not a big deal to them. As Americans, we tend to favor the cock on opening, and because I don't like that little feel of resistance when I'm closing the bolt. It seems like it wants to push the rifle. I'm pushing against a spring, which I don't really care for. But if I operate it fast and you know, mimic what they do, I'm able to use it. It's fine. You know, it's fine. So they're both kind of a draw there. Which one would I really want to choose? I guess if I'm on the Western Front, by the magazine capacity, I would probably choose the SMLE because it's a shorter rifle, so it's handy. It's very handy. And in trenches around, you know, you don't want it to get snagged on wire. You don't want it to get snagged on other things. You know, any kind of, you know, the wood, the, you know, the steps, all the stuff that's around trenches, you know. You don't want it to get snagged. So it's having a shorter rifle is nice. If I were in some place like Mesopotamia or some of these other, you know, kind of far-flung places where I could be shooting at longer range, I would want the P-14. I would want the P-14. Maybe against the Turks, the P-14 would have been a very suitable weapon. But, you know, coming down, you couldn't go far wrong with either one in any situation. I still, though, I really like the P-14. The sights, the trigger is very good. You can get some SMLEs that have some, you know, they break cleanly, but they can have heavy trigger pulls. The P-14 has I think a better trigger pull, which is conducive to accuracy. And it also has a thick barrel. It was that 7mm barrel was made very thick to dissipate heat and to improve accuracy because they thought they would be shooting at boars who were 600 yards or 700 yards away. So they wanted an accurate rifle, so they put a heavy barrel on it for military rifles at the time. And even though the 303 is a little bit larger cartridge, bore diameter-wise, it's still a kind of a heavy barrel there. And it really works out well. And of course, the P-14 was refined into the extremely excellent US Model 1917 rifle, which I think was really, as much as I like the 03 Springfield, I would take a 1917 over a Springfield most of the time. Yeah, I think most of the time. So that's just my impressions. The things of both rifles that I like are recoil with the, I was using British Mark 7 ammunition. I think it was actually loaded, it was loaded somewhere else, but it's Mark 7 ammunition. You know, they both have pretty mild recoil, really. I noticed firing the P-14 and the Model 1917 that the 30-06 develops. You can feel the difference. You can feel the stouter load, and that it's a more powerful round, and you can feel that. It's not bad, but you can definitely tell it's there. And I think that it was a real winner. I think the British did not give the P-14. At a real chance. I think by the time they got it, they said, look, we already got the SMLE. It works. It's great for the trenches. It works. And it can work everywhere else, too. But I think they really should have given it a harder look because they would have probably said, you know, if the P-14 had an extended, if it had the same magazine system, you know, in a perfect world, it has the same magazine system as the SMLE, there's no choice. There's no choice. Even though it's longer and less handy, I think it would have been a much superior rifle, because you would have had the same firepower. So, very interesting to see those two and kind of know which way they went. Really kind of enjoyed that. Really kind of enjoyed that. And the last thing I'll talk about before we go into Q&A is, you know, I miss Cabela's. And Bass Pro Shops, one of my least favorite groups of people, bought them out. And what I have to tell people is, you know, I was always so, my wife used to, you know, she calls Cabela's, she goes, that's the happy place, because people are going in there, they're just happy, they're buying something they really want, something for recreation, so it's really a happy place. So I agreed with that. I had just several experiences with Bass Pro that, you know, the one that really soured me on them was a friend of mine at work. He was a black powder cartridge guy too, and he said, hey, you know, the Bass Pro Shop, then he gave me the location, they've got, you know, 2F black powder down there, 2F and 3F. And I said, great, I'm going to go down there and get some. So I went down there, and the it turns out the guy says, no, we don't have any. It was some geezer, and, you know, he first of all, he asked, well, what do you want it for? I said, I want it because I want it. You know, I want it because I want it. I shoot black powder. I want black powder. Then he tries to sell me on the substitutes. Well, they're so much better. They're safe. He looks at my wife and starts saying, well, they're safer. You know, that all this. I'm like, dude, I'm the one buying here. Talk to me. You know, I'm the person. Talk to me. So, and he didn't even go back. He goes, well, we just don't have any. There was a big reenactment for this weekend, and they bought all the powder. Now, I figured this guy was probably bullshitting me, because reenactors use usually reenactor grade powder. It makes the same kind of sound and smoke, but it's less expensive and it's not as refined, so it's okay, you know. I mean, it's for their purpose, it's fine. But I thought that's kind of strange, so I went back and I went to work the next day, and my friend said, did you get the black powder? And I said, no. I went down there and the guy said they didn't have it anymore. And he goes, well, that was weird, because I went down there yesterday and got some. And so I'm like, So I went back that day, which was the next day from my first visit. Different guy on duty. I ask him, I tell him what I would like, ask him if they have it. He says, I'll go back and check. Comes out with 2 pounds. You know, I said, I would like a pound of each. And he came back with it. And the other guy, and that's why I don't like Bass Pro Shops. Dude, the dude lied. And I don't know, I don't understand why, other than he was just too lazy to go into the back and wanted to sell me the you know, Pyrodex or whatever it is, which I already have. I already have that stuff. That's easy to get. That's what I use when I don't have black powder. I get black powder because I like black powder. So I'm not really into Bass Pro Shop. So I went in there, and of course, they have primers. Not the selection I would like. They had small rifle. They had large pistol magnum. They had large rifle magnum. Shot shell primers, whatever those things are. I don't really load those, so I don't follow them much. And, you know, again, the cheapest thing were the small rifle primers at $89 a thousand. And I sat there and I go, wow, I thought prices of these things were coming down. But apparently, you know, they can still, they know they can gouge and they're still going to do it. So I really don't like them. I realize they don't make the primers, and they probably have very little to do with their pricing, but it always, yeah, Bass Pro Shops never ceases to disappoint me. Another problem they have is they've scaled back their shooting stuff. You know, now it's, there were 3 or 4 aisles, if you will, that had accessories and all kinds of other stuff. Now it's got, like, stuff for your cabin, like, you know, your moose, your moose lamp, you know, the kind of that thing, you know, the lamp that's got the moose on the lampshades, and, you know, a sausage maker, you know, all this kind of cabin-y stuff. They got all that. And of course, going into the gun library, which is what they call their high-end sales room. M1 Garands for $3,000, you know, all this kind of ridiculous prices. Unbelievable. So, yeah, Bass Pro never ceases to disappoint. Well, that ends that. And why don't we go into questions and answers, which is always my favorite part of the podcast because I like what people ask. Okay, here is one. Did you hear about the judgment against Wayne LaPierre for $4.4 million? Yeah, I heard about that. I mean, the liberals thought that this was going to be put the NRA out of business. They didn't find what they were looking for. $4.4 million is nothing. It's nothing. I mean, now if I had it in my bank account, it would be something. But to an organization like that, it's nothing. Did he probably spend incorrectly and do all that? Of course he did. But compared to the Clinton Foundation, this is like stealing gum in the candy store. And the other thing is the Clinton Foundation is the Brinks robbery. So, yeah, nothing much found there. They'll probably get a judgment against him at something. They could have done this just by doing an audit and saying, yeah, you guys did that, and then fining them a couple $1 million, and they actually would have made it. Their investigation and the trial and all this other nonsense probably cost them $20 million by the time it's all said and done. So, yeah, Wayne LaPierre, he authorized some jet airplane rides that he shouldn't have, some helicopter rides, clothes, hairdresser for his wife. Yeah, okay. That compared to the Clinton Foundation is nothing. That compared to most of these foundations is nothing. So, again, I think, you know, when people kind of step back, and it'll probably take a year or two or three, and people will say, yeah, it wasn't that big of a deal, you know, when they get their perspective back. All the LaPierre haters are liking it. They're like, yeah, we told you so. But I look at it this way. Hey, you know, they were looking to try to hang the NRA. If this is the best they got, it shows you what losers that this Letitia James really is. And she is a loser, a complete loser. Okay, next question. Is the VZ-58 superior to the AK-47 and / AKM? I don't know if it's so similar in performance. I know that the internals are different, but the overall envelope of the gun is very similar. The VZ-58 is a little bit lighter and just seems to be a little trimmer in my, that's subjective to me. I like it. I think it's great. Is it superior? No, I don't think so. Is it inferior? No, I don't think so. They're both about the same, so they're both pretty close. The cool part about the VZ-58 is people mistake it for an AK. So when you're shooting it, they'll come up and say, "Oh, is that an AK?" No, it's something else. And so it's they're a lot of fun. They're good rifles, and you know it shows you that the Czechs, of all the people who design weapons, the Czechs come up with some very interesting designs. Some of their early designs are, you know, not too high. You know, the VZ-52 pistol is pretty weird. It's not my favorite pistol to shoot, that's for sure. But I do have to say that when it comes to just innovation, they're like the old H&K, you know, Heckler & Koch. You know, they came up with the VP-70Z, which to modern standards is a horrible pistol. I mean, it's just horrible. Heavy double action only pull. By the time you emptied and it had like an 18 shot magazine. By the time you emptied that magazine, your hand was so freaking tired, your trigger finger was so tired that you couldn't shoot it anymore. You know, you're done. You know, when you compare that now, 17, 18 rounds is pretty standard in a lot of 9mm pistols. So, but it was so unique. It was just so unique. A lot of their designs were very, very unique. That's kind of how the Czechs are. Their stuff, if you like uniqueness, their stuff is it. Okay, next question. Is the Makarov still a good defensive choice? No, I mean, just, well, it's a firearm. It has enough power to be lethal. The 9mm Makarov is, they always say it's in between a 380 and a 9mm. It's closer to the 9mm Parabellum. It's a small pistol. It's one of those kind of pistols. It's like the 1934 Beretta. It can be either a concealed small pistol, or you can, it's just large enough that you can use it as a service automatic, you know, and use it as a police gun. So it kind of, you know, it's Walther PP kind of size. So it's you know, it can kind of be both. You can kind of do either with it. Which, if you're fielding this to a huge number of people, and it can do a variety of roles, it's already a good gun. But is it state of the art? No, hasn't been for. It's really World War II type technology. You know, the heel release, the cartridge. All that kind of screams of, you know, post, just after World War II. So, and I like World War II guns. So, you know, it's a great gun. It's a great gun, but it's certainly not state of the art. But, you know, again, going back to the captured weapons things, people who did not have a sidearm in the initial invasion of Iraq were scooping those things up like crazy because, hey, you got that, and it's a sidearm. You know, it's something, so it's better than nothing. So they were scooping those up like crazy. Another instance of using kind of captured weapons. So there you go. All right. Why did the British go from 4.55 Webley to 38, or what they called 380? In service handguns in between the world wars? And the answer I can tell you is I have no idea. The cartridge they effectively adopted to replace the 4.55 was effectively the 38 Smith & Wesson / 38 New Colt Police, Colt New Police, which was an 1880s. Yeah. Why they adopted that, I don't know. 38 Special. I tell you why they adopted it. They adopted it because it could fit into a smaller Webley pistol, because the big Webley pistols were harder to shoot. They were heavier and all that. They wanted to go to trim. There was a movement right after the First World War to kind of lighten everything down and make it trimmer, because they thought that the next war, and they were correct, would be a war of movement. And when you're moving around, the less weight you have, the more efficient. They needed more efficient weapons. A lot of these things, they were trying to make it smaller, lighter, but still have a punch. They failed with the 38 Webley, in my opinion, but that's just my opinion. And that's why the 455s, just because they existed and everything else, that's why they were still so used, because they were eminently serviceable, powerful, you know, really a good sidearm. The 38 just kind of went. And in fact, I think right after the war, basically the British, although they still had them and used them, they really went to the Browning high power 9mm pistol. So. It was not really. It's not really looked upon as a high water mark in service handguns. Here's an interesting one. If you had to choose one end of civilization rifle, what would it be? You know, and of course everybody. You know, there have been. You could probably fill an encyclopedia set with the number of articles and arguments on the internet and everything. If I had to choose just one rifle, and I knew that it was in a prolonged without rule of law type scenario, so I'm going to be out there, you know, you're going to have to be prepared to shoot. You know, the easy answer is, well, it's an AR because you can carry all kinds of ammo and blah, 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 blah. All those arguments. Or an AK because it's so reliable and you can carry all this ammo, blah, 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 all those arguments. I would tell you, and I'd have to get friend of the podcast's opinion on this, because he shoots one too. I would go with an HK-91 clone, G3 clone, with the Hensold or the German Army scope. I think when it comes to accuracy, reliability, toughness, durability, power, because it's 7.62 NATO, quality, because Hensold, and there were other manufacturers that made them to the same standard. That's a great system. Spare parts are easy. They're easy to install. There's a lot of great things. Now, is it the only choice? No. Is it maybe the best choice for everyone? No. But I think that, you know, when you look at something, what are the attributes you'd like to have? I think that rifle scope combo has them. I mean, if you need to shoot a moose, you can do it. You're going to kill a moose with that thing. If you need to shoot a grizzly bear, you're going to do that. If you need to punch a hole in some kind of a vehicle, you're going to do that. If you need to hit somebody at longer range, you're going to be able to do that. So it's got a lot of great attributes, and you know, it's one of those things. If you have to choose one, you've got to choose one that can do a lot of different things. It may not be the perfect choice, but it's going to be a good choice. So that's the one I would choose. And I actually have one, and I've shot it. I have managed at 300 yards offhand, you know, with the scope. You know, I could hit a 24-inch gong with that, which that's pretty good. That's offhand. That's really good. What are your favorite World War I cartridges? I think I've talked about this a lot in the past, so I'll just kind of go over it again real quick. I would think that the optimal cartridge for World War I, from the cartridges that were there, I would go with 7mm Mauser for rifles and light machine guns. And hey, if I need to have another cartridge for the heavy water-cooled machine guns, hey, so be it, you know, so what? You could probably get away with 7mm Mauser, though, to do that. My other favorite cartridge would be 7.65x53 Belgian/Argentine. I think that was a great cartridge. It basically is kind of like it's similar enough. It's in between a 30-40 Krag and a 308. I think that was a great cartridge. I think it was a great cartridge, and really didn't get the look or the use that it really should have. Although apparently the Turks used it quite a bit, so that would do that. The next would be 30-06. It was a modern hard-hitting cartridge. Really excellent. Then I would go 303 British and 7.62x54, about the same. They're both rimmed. They both shoot about the same bullet at the same velocity. Good cartridge. Good cartridges. You know, below that you start getting into 8mm Lebels and some of those 8x50 and 8x56 and some of these other things that just don't really interest me that much. So I just don't think they were that great at cartridges, and that the reason they died off is because of that. So those are it. Okay, next question. Why were Germany and Britain able to adopt and refine newer bolt-action rifles in the 1890s and early 1900s, but Russia did not? Russia did to a degree. I mean, they came out with Dragoon rifles, and they kind of modernized the rear sights. The deal with Russia that's different from Britain, Germany, the United States, is that their army was huge, it was much larger, and it was far-flung. You're talking from, you know, Eastern Europe all the way out to Korea. You know, you're talking out to the Pacific Ocean. It's massive. And so when you make a choice, when you're administering something that large, you're stuck with it. So you better choose well, because you're stuck with it. And they had, because not only is the army huge, so making a change is big, but it's also a lot of this stuff has to be transported thousands of miles back to where these changes are going to be instituted and take place. So everybody, you know, it's a massive undertaking, and it's going to, upgrading something's going to take years. Withdrawing something and issuing something new in its place is going to take years. It might take you 2 or 3 years of manufacturing a rifle just to get enough so that you can issue them to this giant spread out army. So that's the primary reason. The other reason is, effectively, nobody wants to admit this, but when you look at other rifles that were adopted around 1890, 1891, 1892, the Moissan Nagant is a good rifle. It's a very good rifle. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. In World War I, there was nothing wrong with it. In World War II, there was nothing wrong with it. It just, technology was surpassing it. Autoloaders were going to be the future, but, you know, it does what it's supposed to do. And it may not be as slick or refined as some of the other ones, but its accuracy, its durability, and reliability are there. And those were the features they were looking for, along with the you know, the power of the cartridge. It was actually a good, I think, a very, very good rifle. And, you know, again, nothing lasts, nothing endures forever. And it became obsolete in World War II, essentially. It became, you know, it would still do everything it was designed to do, but competitive rifles, starting with their own SVT-38 and SVT-40, would definitely kind of make it obsolescence. The same way that, you know, the M1 Garand made the 1903 and 1917 obsolescent. The same way that, you know, the German semi-automatic G41 and G43 and later STG-44 made their bolt-action rifles obsolete. So, you know, it had a good run and did well, but it was not, the environment was not conducive for that to be tweaked and upgraded the way that the British were able to do with their, you know, the Lee Enfield and the Lee Metford Lee Enfield and short magazine Lee Enfield. They went through that whole iterative process of developing the rifle into the SMLE, and you know, Russia did not really have that ability. They couldn't just churn these rifles through an arsenal and continually upgrade them. They kind of went to the field and they kind of had to be there, which is why you find M91s in World War II. You know, I mean, it should have been the 9130, and the 9130 had, you know, some, okay, it's got different sights. That's really the biggest thing. But, you know, you find a lot of the older pattern rifles because, you know, they just, getting those things in service is a hassle, but also pulling them out of service to upgrade them, change them, or replace them is another big hassle. It's just the way it is. And I think even in World War I, the Russians were using, you know, like a lot of countries did, they had, you know, stocks of the older rifles, the Berdan IIs and some of these other things. Hey, they had to come out of storage and get used, because you're talking about arming an incredibly large force that's spread way out. So that's why that is. Okay, well, that about wraps it up for this edition of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you exactly like it is. And, you know, again, I told you, email me at kbmakel@aol.com, or put the comments in the comments section on Podbean, and that's how you can get in touch with me and ask a question. But until next time, this is Old School Guns, out.